Hello, and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. The summer season is in full swing, and A Midsummer Night's Dream has arrived in the Globe Theatre in full Technicolor. This irreverent story of lovers, royalty, fairies and actors, crossing paths in a forest outside Athens, is one we come back to again and again. It's riotous comedy and lilting poetry, bringing Midsummer Madness to life. But like all Shakespeare plays, underneath the frothing fun is a dark underbelly. Couples turning on each other, marriages forced on unwilling partners, women escaping with real fear for their lives, and woven through it all, the fairy drug that drives them to do things they might not otherwise have done. There is more than a whiff of misogyny threaded into A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Shakespeare's plays more generally, and with it comes, hand in hand, racism, homophobia, classism, and more. Here's Farrar on the problem of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and the dark side to that dream.
It's not just misogyny, but it's all the other kinds of things, like the sort of racial elements of Shakespeare's plays, you know, if we're going to be intersectional. That, you know, this play in particular talks about changing a dove for a raven and uses racially charged language in the scenes in the forest. And what I love about our production is that our company have really dealt with that and have confronted that. So I think you could say the misogyny, the racism in Shakespeare is an issue. It's an issue because we in the 21st century want to keep teaching Shakespeare. We want to keep performing Shakespeare. And increasingly, audiences, students are saying, why? There's other people that we should be studying, right? People that speak to me and to my identity. So actually, I think it's important to highlight the misogyny and the racism in Shakespeare as a site upon which to continue discussing Shakespeare and continue performing Shakespeare. That is what will keep Shakespeare alive, is confronting those elements rather than editing them out or trying to make them more palatable so that we can somehow lie to people and say Shakespeare was the perfect god who is universal and appeals to everybody, because he doesn't. And our job is to say to people why we should keep doing Shakespeare. And it doesn't have to be because he can teach us how to be good humans. It could be because actually we can learn how to be good humans if we contest what's in the plays. And you can detest it if you want to. But having an ongoing dialogue and confrontation with the work is actually the best way to engage with the plays. Directors often, they need to land on some kind of, not necessarily solution, but some kind of attitude. Because if you've got a comedy like Midsummer Night's Dream, you've got to make people laugh, you know? Otherwise, the practicalities of theater, which Shakespeare knew too, being a theater man, are that you've got to get bums on seats and you've got to make people have a good time, and you're in the summer and you're in the Globe and the weather's good and the drinks are being served and there's bunting everywhere, and you got to have a good time. But I think that you can achieve that while still saying, this is tricky.
So this week on the podcast, we'll be asking, what's the dark side to Shakespeare's comedies? Is Shakespeare misogynistic? And as 21st century theatregoers, what do we make of the misogyny in Shakespeare? First up, me and Farrar sat down to talk around some of the issues of A Midsummer Night's Dream and how the women of the play find themselves lured, trapped and silenced.
So, to start off, do you think Shakespeare is a misogynist?
Do I think Shakespeare is a misogynist? Well, I would say sometimes Shakespeare wants you to think he's a misogynist. But I think it's very dangerous to try to take too much of a biographical view, because there's such a plurality of opinions expressed in Shakespeare's work that it's really hard to say, ooh, Shakespeare was a misogynist. Because then you could say, oh, Shakespeare was a murderer. Or Shakespeare was a racist. Or, you know, because there are characters that express every kind of opinion that ever existed. So it's difficult. I think, actually, if I was asked, you're going to lose your life if you don't answer this question, then I would say, probably not. And the reason I would say that is because he writes female characters in a way that is insightful and hopeful or optimistic. So it's almost as though he can imagine a time in which women could lead or be heard by a collective. And so I think it's a live question, and I think it would produce a lot of interesting discussion in a classroom or in a rehearsal room, because there are things that you can point to in his texts, like if you look at Taming of the Shrew, the sort of stereotypes that were around at the time about women, and certainly around now, about women being too vocal and loud and expressing opinions in a particular way and aggressive and needing to be tamed, as it were. That kind of perception still exists. So yes, you can certainly point to moments in the text where it appears Shakespeare is advocating a misogynistic philosophy, but actually what he's doing is he's showing you the reality of human relationships, and the reality of his time and our own is that women are viewed by too many to be second-class citizens, and when they try to step out of that mold, it causes trouble.
So let's talk briefly about Dream, which is currently showing. You know, Dream is so often performed as like the big summer play.
Yeah.
It's bright and it's frothy and there's loads going on, but it's also really dark. What are the elements of Dream that really trouble you?
I guess the elements of Dream that trouble me are one main element, which is if you think about Dream from the perspective of the women in the play. I remember attending a lecture years ago by an eminent Shakespeare scholar who was saying that Dream is has such a high aesthetic quality, that it's a beautiful play to listen to and to watch and to experience. And I remember thinking, well, not if you're Hermia or if you're Titania when she wakes up. So it feels as though that play has a sort of underbelly of experience, which is predominantly the female experience. So Hermia is told at the beginning that she cannot choose her life. She can't be with the man that she loves. If she goes the way her father says she's not allowed to, then she either has to join a convent or she will be killed. So the law, the patriarchal law, is that if you don't listen to your father and do as he's told, you will suffer the worst consequence. And so she has to run away. And when she's in the woods, she becomes disconnected and disorientated from the reasons that she went into the woods. She experiences a nightmare. She wakes up from a nightmare and finds that her lover is missing. And so that experience is one of fear. And the woods in Shakespeare's time was not just a place that, you know, As You Like It would have it, which is a place for community and rural play. It is also a very frightening world. So let's think about the woods in Titus Andronicus. This is where the worst rape and mutilation in Shakespeare's work occurs. And so Shakespeare is alluding to all of these different meanings of the woods, and it can be a very scary place for a woman. Helena's situation is she finds herself rejected and in a position where she shouldn't be rejected because she represents the ideal of beauty that's been dictated by society for generations. And so she cannot understand why she's not appealing. So she finds herself in pursuit of love, and that she feels degraded by that. She feels shamed by that, but she can't stop herself. And then when there's a sense that both of these lovers are in love with her, she becomes, her self-loathing goes into high gear, and she doesn't believe them for a second. So Shakespeare gives you women who are afraid because of the circumstances that they're in. He gives you women who express that gut-level self-loathing that is innate to the female condition, because society has created a world where you have to feel inadequate and to know your place. If you think about Titania, for example, she is the fairy queen, right? She has power, she has authority, and that is immediately taken away from her because of this flower, this drug. So Oberon goes to really uncomfortable levels in order to get what he wants. You know, he dominates her, he tames her. He's another Petruchio in many ways. And then when the play opens, it opens with Theseus and Hippolyta. And if you know this story, the classic story of Theseus and Hippolyta, she was queen of the Amazons, and she was dominated by Theseus. She was conquered, and there's all kinds of narratives around her being raped by him and kidnapped by him. And Shakespeare starts the play with that myth as a kind of ghost haunting the world of the play. And so he wants you to think about how women are subjugated by men and how power in women can be so easily taken away. So that world is happening in the underbelly of the play, and it's deeply, deeply unsettling.
When we take that ending of the play and the three marriages and everyone coming back together, is that an uncomfortable silencing of women? Is that some sort of community between the women in their shared experience?
Well, if you think about Hermia and Helena, they get what they want, don't they? But if I was Helena, I would be, when's that juice going to wear off? You know, I mean, it's a little bit destabilizing. And if, I think Shakespeare does that deliberately. At the end of most of his comedies, when you end with, you know, triple, double marriages, it's always Shakespeare's always asking you to think about why people get married and what the purpose of marriage is. And I think we are meant to feel slightly uncomfortable with that final arrangement. And certainly with Hippolyta and Theseus, and it very much depends upon how Hippolyta is played. Some actresses play Hippolyta as deeply in love with Theseus and really there in present in the nuptials. And some play her as having to be wooed again, or as being scornful, or feeling as though she is actually in a, I suppose, tyrannical situation in which she does not want to be there, but she has to be. So much of that nuance that's in the ending is something that can be determined by a director and her company of actors, as it were. I guess the play is trying to give you a sense of community at the end. And certainly when they're watching the play within a play, Shakespeare says nothing unites people as well as theater does. But yeah, I think we are meant to feel a little unsettled at that ending.
Next up, I sat down with Jocelyn G. Essien and Nadine Higgin, who play Bottom and Peter Quince in our production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, to talk about misogyny and racism in Shakespeare, why now is the moment for women of colour to take on these roles, and whether Shakespeare was actually ahead of his time.
Do you think Dream is a misogynistic play?
Straight in there.
Yeah, there's definitely elements. I think it's definitely heavily male populated. A lot of the time in scenes, females are quiet and silenced, with decisions being made about them and for them, around them, with them not really having a say.
Yeah.
Bar Hermia.
It's definitely of a time, isn't it? And I think it's even more prevalent. I just wanted to say that word. That's what it means. But let's just put it in. It's more prevalent, or as the French say, prevalement, of the time now where, like, you know, I suppose in the script, it has moments of saying, you know, marry this guy or you die. Either die or join a nunnery. And there's lots of those lines in Shakespeare, actually. So a lot of Shakespeare is actually quite misogynistic. But these days now, like, there's sort of like a tongue-in-cheek about it, I think, is the way we're getting around it. But so much of Shakespeare's misogyny. There's so much of the man coming to save the woman and...
But something that I... And this might be just looking at it from the other side, which I do a lot. Something I sometimes wonder is, I feel like Shakespeare was aware of what he was doing and was almost doing it so obviously to point the finger at society. And there's obviously... I mean, I wish it could like be like, hey, mate, Shakespeare, tell me your views. No. But totally guessing and looking at it, there is a part of me that feels, or maybe just wants to think.
Yeah, that you're hoping that that's true.
He was actually, because I think he's really ahead of his time, and it would be really nice to think that he was being so openly obvious about the settings that it was more of a, this is what you guys are doing, as opposed to, this is how I feel.
Yeah.
That might
just, or Shakespeare's just a sexist, racist, homophobe.
And that is
and we don't want to think that.
Very possible.
Because there's lots of stuff in the play as well about race as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So this is definitely a direct reflect of the times that he was working in. I just would like to think, as a creative mind, he was aware of this and used his platform to spread
Let's
awareness.
Go with that. Let's go with
is
that.
Is that me being too hopeful?
No, let's know, because, I mean, people just don't want to think that of Shakespeare. Yeah. And like I say, we don't know, but... But in a way, maybe he was that person, because when you look at some of his sonnets as well, there are, I mean, I suppose I'm going back to race and stuff, when you look at the both of those, there's sort of like a juxtaposition. You know, I'm liking these words.
Just chucking them in there.
Do you know what I mean? Who knows what they mean? But, you know, let's just try and get it in. Come on. You know, I might even put in a bit of discombobulation.
Right.
You know? I mean, come on now. Come on. What does it mean?
This is literally what it's like working with her every day.
But like beauty was seen as like fair, mm-hmm. light, etc. Mm-hmm. Even just, not just dark skin, but dark hair, dark eyes was evil.
Yeah,
was,
generally like know, darkness yeah. is always the bad.
It is, but then Shakespeare has these sonnets to the dark lady. They're saying they're like someone that he, who was definitely a black woman mm. that he was writing this sonnet to. That, you know, so maybe he is one just ahead of his time, isn't he?
Get in, William.
The original male Kardashian, having a bit of chocolate, isn't it? Shakespeare, eh? Maybe his middle name was Kardashian.
I love that.
So you both play characters in the play who are traditionally played by men.
Yeah.
And it's never really mentioned.
When I first got the role, I was thinking that we'd have to be so aware of calling each other she instead of he, or
yeah,
it's not in the script, you know, apart from people saying Peter Quince when they first come up, and you know, we're assuming that the name Peter is male. Other than that, it's never been an issue. It's not referred to within the text, because we've not cut it out. It's just not been there. So I don't actually think it makes a difference at all. The only one that I think actually makes an obvious visual difference is playing Aegeus. You know, she's spoken about, or he's spoken about, as the father. And obviously what we were talking about before with the women being put on trial and silenced, I do sometimes feel like there's that weird tilt of the scale, because actually I am playing a man, but I am physically there, a woman who has got a very big voice in that scene. As a woman playing the role, I found a weird, crazy level of strength and power. Now, I don't know what that means or what that says, but I had this funny thing of when I was first trying to find who Aegeus was, and then I started literally leading with my dick. Literally, when I was walking, do you remember that day? Yeah. And I was just a bit like, how would he walk? And then I just, like it was a weird sort of pelvis power that came with when I realised that I was allowed. And that came because I realised I was a man.
Yeah.
What does that say about me? Everything that I stand
there's
for.
There's something you want to tell us. But it does, but it just works. Yeah. It just works. And we don't even think about it, like playing Quince and Bottom.
No.
Because, I mean, we're flirting with men. We're flirting with women in the audience.
Yeah, we're just
free. We're all up in this bizzle, you know?
I would say that we're definitely females, but we're just
I think the audience see us as females.
Yeah.
But we're not really just playing females. We're just playing...
We're just the characters. I think it's the best way that it came in as well. It was just... And there was never a moment where we thought, oh, hang on a minute, I'm a bloke.
Now people just want to see this on stage with no explanation, no apology. Just, this is it. And they all accept it.
The seamless way that it goes as well, it makes you realise that if you're just telling the truth and telling the story, it doesn't matter what's going
on. Yeah.
Like, and that is what I think, no matter what we've done or how crazy we've gone, we're always telling the truth and telling the story, and, you know.
Yeah. Connect with them. Make them understand. Make them laugh. Make them feel something. That's all they want.
And when that fails, just pretend to roar and call up
just
a killer.
Roar. Or snog. Snog the nearest person next to you. They love a snog, don't they? They're just cheering for the snogs. I mean, what is this at the Globe? Just snogs.
Just snog.
Though I am an honest pup, we will have an early glut. Now to escape the serpent's tongue, we will make amends ere long.
Else the puck a liar call.
And so good night unto you all.
So give me your hands if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends.
I wanted to ask a bit about comedy. It's such a funny show. Like, it's such an old and bad cliche that women aren't funny and that women can't play funny roles. And cross-gender casting is like everywhere, but you don't see it as much in funny roles.
Yeah, you're right. Again, just bigging up a man like Sean, Sean Holmes, director, he just doesn't...
Please employ us again.
Please employ us again. Soon. He doesn't actually see any of that, does he? He just... He is one of those rare gems in this world that just sees people who they are, what their talent is, what he thinks they can do, and will just put them in a role. Like, I would never have seen myself in Quince. And the fact that we went into that rehearsal room and he was just like, no, because it's you, it's what you've already given me, which then gave me the freedom to just then be, it didn't have any restraint or restrictions. And I think it's that thing of if there's representation, if it's seen, people will dig it. It's the fear of the unknown at the end of the day. Once it's done, people don't question.
Yeah. See, I'm the opposite. I didn't know how much I really wanted to play bottom until I was given the opportunity. It's the best role I've ever played in my life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you just need someone like Sean who like you say, who just it. Sees, yeah. like, actually, this role is like that, blah, blah, and that could be a man or woman, black or white, short, tall, whatever. But, like, having that opportunity, it's like, I never thought that I really wanted to play bottom until I played bottom. You know of the role because it's iconic, mm-hmm. and it's, like, one of the most iconic comedic Shakespeare roles. Mm-hmm. But never seen myself in it until I had this opportunity. It's like, this is the role that I've been dying to play, but I didn't know it. It
makes so much sense. It's so
and
you.
Now I'm here playing it, which
so
is...
so you. Day one in rehearsals, it just makes brilliant. Sense.
Until you get these opportunities, you know, and this is the time. It is in a way, I just feel like, where else can you go, though? I think enough men have played this role, so it's like, it's time to... Where do you...
Boring.
Yeah, where
move
do you go?
On, move
you, like,
forward.
And it's women of colour as well. Like, yeah, there's just like...
So many
there's loads
levels,
of us on
yeah.
stage... And it's what he's written. It's like, for years, we've always seen the female lovers, like, you know, whether it's Hermia, Helena, oh, Juliet, Miranda, you know, they're weak. Always these weak characters.
Demure,
but
dainty.
Shakespeare, he doesn't write weak characters. But for years, for centuries, there's always been these, you know, and no one wants to play those roles except...
Look at
unless
Hermia
you're like,
and Helena's
and you look at
text.
These and go, yeah.
It's fighting text. It's... And I've never actually noticed that or paid attention to that until I heard Amanda and Faith say it.
People are coming in going, Hermia's my idol, because she's this feisty. It's like, but she's never usually this feisty, but what Faith is doing with her.
And it's all written.
Little girl's going, I want to be Hermia.
Yeah.
That's so, it's just touching.
It's way touching.
So, having done the show for a while and having had this conversation, do you still think Shakespeare is misogynistic? If so, does it matter?
It's down to interpretation. Also, I think maybe a lot of the directors have been misogynistic. Maybe that's what it's about. Yeah. Or the actors have been. Because if you get certain actors who are used to it being played in a certain way, and you always get those actors in those roles, nothing changes. And it just takes one director or a different kind of cast to come and actually give another angle.
I think if you look at, which you shouldn't do with anything in my opinion, but if you look at it very black and white, surface level, that's how it reads, that's how it seems. But again, I do think that he has put his hidden underlayers in there, that it just takes someone to actually break through that, to realise,
you have
women
choice.
In it, it's fighting talk from those girls, fighting talk the whole way through. You can't ignore sometimes what is written and how it's been written. I just feel like there's a deeper level of meaning to it all than sometimes people have hit.
But it's of a time as well, isn't it? That whenever you're doing it, we have this duty to make it relatable to now. So you know, even moments in the play, if we just skim over that, the audience are going to be really frustrated with us.
And actually, things are still so relevant.
Yeah. Shakespeare was a black, gay woman. That's my statement. And I stand by it, right? And if anyone's got a problem with that... That's fine. I'll take it back and say I didn't mean it like that. All right?
That's a strong statement. Just take it
back.
Right. Take it back.
That's right.
Oh, I see what you mean, though. I think he's definitely a champion. I think he was a secret champion. And I think that if he lived in a different time, he would have probably voiced things more openly. At the end of the day, he had to still put on his place. And,
yeah, without getting killed.
And make some dollar. Yeah. So we have to give him a, you know. But I definitely think he was a champion of work. I feel like he was very outspoken for what we're used to of the time.
I mean, obviously black people were there, because people always think that black people just arrived in the 70s on skates.
Yeah. Oh my God.
But black people were there, but it's just that we never, what role did they play? Were they in the theatre? Did they play any roles? Because every time it's mentioned, you think, well, if he keeps mentioning dark this and black that, and I mean, it's, and the more, like, I mean, you look at Othello, thinking, where did he get all of that from?
Yeah, it has to
do you know what I mean?
It
must be, he must have seen a black person.
Oh, 100%.
To write about them, do you know what I mean? So,
yeah. No, I think that.
And the best role in Othello is Iago.
I feel like the character.
Sorry, just put that in. Do you know what I mean? So you need a black actor. Well, no, it's equality when the black actor wipes up and plays Iago.
I definitely feel like the characters existed when it comes to the misogyny.
I mean, I like to think that Shakespeare was writing specifically about particular people, whether it was race, but it's just that we've never seen them. So I'm thinking like Hermia, it's definitely in the text that she's dark. Yeah. But I think over time they just thought, oh, just make her brunette.
Yeah.
He's talking about her hair, isn't he?
Because you Ethiop is a very
a
very strong statement. It's not you semi-tanned person that's possibly from Spain. It is you Ethiop.
Yes,
like that is full on dark African.
So was it then played by a black man?
I mean, I'd love that, but I doubt it highly.
An ancestor of Lenny Henry. Playing Hermia.
It could have just been Lenny Henry himself.
What,
he's been around forever.
Yeah, he never dies. Lenny, vampire. Did you play Hermia back in the 15th century, babes? It was Lenny. It's Lenny.
It was
Lenny. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, there is this gap, isn't there? There is this gap where you go, there must have been. Yeah,
definitely.
Let's just assume Shakespeare knew. But then his work has been crushed and redefined and origamied.
But I do feel that that has happened. I do feel that's happened anyway.
Because what isn't a shame if you go, he was writing about us, and then as time's gone on, we're all erased. So let's live in hope and say he was intentionally writing for women and writing about women.
He was an activist.
And different races and,
Finally, I caught up with Isabel Marr, assistant director for this summer's Globe tour. The tour ensemble is taking Pericles, Twelfth Night and A Comedy of Errors on the road, and each night it's up to the audience to decide which one they want to see. As they head back home for a glorious return to the Globe Theatre, I chatted to Isabel about how you deal with these really knotty, problematic turns in Shakespeare as a director, and in particular, the extra pressure on young female directors when it comes to the unsolvable problem of misogyny in Shakespeare.
So, not to put you on the spot, but to jump in the deep end.
Yeah.
Do you think Shakespeare's a misogynist?
Ooh. Obviously, in the context of our modern society, he's a massive misogynist. I think, what's the statistic? Something like 16% of his characters are women and all the rest are men. You know, most of his strong female characters either only get taken seriously when they're dressed up as men, and as soon as they come out of their disguise, they kind of go silent and are ignored again, or they end up killing themselves, or they get married off to someone they don't necessarily feel anything towards, or let alone love. But obviously we need to think about him in the context of when he was writing. I think for his time, he was actually, compared to a lot of his contemporaries, incredibly ahead of his time. If you look at some of his characters, I think he definitely was quite radical in sort of subverting that idea that women should just stay at home and shouldn't sort of think for themselves, and certainly shouldn't do anything that men do.
Particularly the comedies are often seen as like these sort of frothy, light summer shows.
Yeah.
And they're really dark sometimes.
Yeah.
As a director, what do you do with some of those sort of really knotty, problematic things in Shakespeare plays, especially shows where you're literally telling people that they're going into a comedy?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a matter of personal taste, but I personally don't really believe in sort of changing or editing them too much to avoid these things. I think not just with regards to misogyny, but also, you know, in terms of racism and homophobia and classism and all sorts. I think if you edit that ugly stuff out of Shakespeare and you shy away from it, then you've literally got nothing left. So I think, and particularly, you know, with misogyny, there's so much of it embedded in all the plays, as you say, especially some of the comedies, that if you take that out, why are we telling these stories at all?
So if you were asked to do a production of The Taming of the Shrew, would you do it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the whole point is to sort of shine a light upon these plays and these issues. I don't think it's our job to tell the audience, you know, this is what you should think of this play. I think it's up to the audience to take what they will from it. I think, I mean, the whole Me Too movement came about right from people speaking up and telling these stories. So surely by editing these plays or not doing the ones that are really problematic, we're not really helping the situation because, you know, these same kind of things are still going on today. These stories are so prevalent that if you just kind of say, oh no, that makes me feel too uncomfortable or that's too tricky, it doesn't really help anyone. I think a massive thing is casting. I'm a big believer in sort of cross-gender casting, not always just every woman playing a man and every man playing a woman, and not just doing it for the sake of doing it sort of as a gimmick, but I think for certain characters it can be incredibly helpful in terms of when you've got the really thorny, problematic speeches and lines, like we're doing Twelfth Night on the tour at the minute, certain lines that both Viola and Orsino have, our frailty is the cause, not we, for such as we're made or such we be. There's something about seeing someone of the opposite gender saying those words that sort of creates a distance between like the actor and the character, and it sort of jars. So the audience don't necessarily take it as read, and I don't think you need to edit it, and you don't even need to say it in a particularly kind of jokey or sarcastic way, or you don't need to kind of force your own message or agenda on it. But I think just by having someone of the opposite gender say some of those really tricky things, it can be enough.
What do you think is the worst instance of misogyny in Shakespeare? I mean, the Shrew's an obvious one.
I mean, yeah, Shrew is an obvious
one.
What's
the one that really gets you?
Oh God, that's so difficult. I mean, it was Measure's an obvious one as well. I think Shrew and Measure are the two most problematic ones, but I think pretty much every play has something very problematic. I think sometimes when it really bothers me is when it seems to be doing quite well, and it seems to be a kind of relatively, compared to the other plays, relatively feminist play. Like, you know, just in terms of the ones I'm doing at the minute, like in Twelfth Night, we actually have Viola being played by a man. But as a female character, you think, oh, she's incredibly sort of complex and nuanced and quite progressive, and she's dressed up as a man and she's been stranded in this land where she doesn't know anyone, and she's of a very high status, but she's having to dress up as a servant for survival, and she's fallen in love for the first time, and yet she's not able to tell the man she loves because she needs to survive, and she's this quite sort of powerful woman who we're all rooting for and who is this incredible survivor. And then right at the end, as soon as she is revealed to be a woman and she tells Orsino, and Orsino says, oh, marvellous, I love you too, let's get married, hooray, it's marvellous, she suddenly just goes silent. She sort of doesn't speak for the last few pages of the play. So I think it's also instances like that where you think, oh, we're doing so well, and then it's kind of like right at the end, as soon as we get to the point where we think this could have a really sort of promising, positive feminist outlook, everything's kind of tied up in a nice sort of like neat misogynistic bow at the end, and they're kind of like put back in their place as like, oh, well, you're a woman now, so you have to just be married off and be the wife and the mother again.
Do you think that's like a... It's incredibly irritating as an audience member, but do you think there's part of that that's a bit of a like wink, wink, nudge, nudge from Shakespeare as a writer?
It's really hard to know. It's definitely sometimes played like that, and I sometimes like to sort of direct it a bit like that as well. But it's kind of really hard to know. The times when I think, yeah, he must. I mean, even in Shrew, that final speech, you know, so many people think it is a bit. It's sort of said ironically, but at the same time, there's so much just sort of casual sexism littered throughout these plays as well that it's. That then I think, oh, I don't know how he can write that and at the same time be I mean, I think he honestly he was incredibly ahead of his time. He was quite feminist for his time. I'm not sure that he was that far ahead that he was doing the wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I'd really like to think that he was. But I think it's fine that we do sometimes impose that on these plays. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think even sometimes if we don't impose them on the plays, I think sometimes the audience will just interpret them to be that way, to have that wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And I think that's fine because, as I said, it's all about what the audience, how the audience want to interpret it, really.
For podcast listeners, Izzy just winked at me.
Wait, wait, nudge, nudge.
Do you feel like as a sort of younger woman working in the industry that mm-hmm. there is a sort of pressure on you in the way that there isn't to older or more established men to sort of solve these elements of the play and to sort of bring a feminist version of something which is in its essence not born of that movement?
Yeah, definitely. I do. I don't personally feel the need to solve them. There definitely is a pressure as a young female director within the industry nowadays to do that. But I don't think we need to solve these plays as such. But what I think we need to do is recognise the many different levels of misogyny within both the plays and the reflection of the society in which the play was written, but also in terms of our society today and also the theatre industry today, and sort of try and subvert some of those sort of power structures in a way, firstly by having more women involved in these plays in terms of all the creatives and in terms of, you know, having more female actors. And secondly, just I think there's ways you can highlight some of the thornier issues in the play without actually having to edit them. So for example, in Pericles, we're doing Pericles on the tour at the minute. Marina, Pericles' daughter, has an incredibly tough time. She's separated from her parents at birth. Her mother dies during childbirth. She's sort of adopted by another couple who try to murder her. Then she gets kidnapped by pirates and sold for prostitution. But she's actually sort of incredibly powerful. She's a survivor. She manages to escape this brothel that she's been sold into. So she's a character we're sort of really rooting for. And right at the end of the play, she's reunited with Pericles and they have this wonderful emotional scene. Then she's reunited with her mother and again, incredibly sort of lovely and emotional and everything sort of tied in a nice bow. And then it's just announced that she's going to be married off to this man who she met when he came into the brothel when she was working as a prostitute and he was trying to have sex with her in exchange for money. And she doesn't have any lines after that happens. And obviously, any director like can recognise the misogyny in something like Taming of the Shrew, like the really obvious things that people are still talking about. But smaller moments like that, I think, sometimes might just be brushed over. And so I don't think you need to add in any other lines or sort of edit it. But I think just by virtue of having a strong, powerful female woman play that part, which we do, she can literally just sort of give a look to the audience and react in a certain way that can just sort of shine a light on those moments that might sometimes be brushed over.
You mentioned Me Too.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the conversation around classical texts and Shakespeare and misogyny has moved on since all of that's happened?
Moved on in the sense of,
firstly, is it being spoken about more? Is it more like explicitly acknowledged? And also, like you were saying, it's not just about like taking a text as it is. There's years of performance history and theatre history that goes behind each play as well. Do you feel like those conversations are being had more, and do you feel more able to have those conversations?
Yeah, definitely. For me, I feel like the biggest thing it's done is shown sort of, I mean, it's obviously shown how far we have to go. And so in terms of my approach, which is, as I said, not necessarily solving the play myself, but letting the audience sort of take what they will from it, I think it's more changed the audience and how they receive the play. I think before Me Too, obviously not so much with women, but some of the male audience members perhaps might have seen these societies that are being depicted as more distant from our own than they now do. So I think it kind of makes these plays feel a little bit closer to home. Thank you.
That's it from us, but you can catch A Midsummer Night's Dream in the Globe Theatre until the 13th of October. Audience Choice will be back in the Globe Theatre from the 17th to the 24th of August for 5 performances only, when it will be up to you, the audience, to vote on which play you'd like to see, Pericles, Twelfth Night, or A Comedy of Errors. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, and Dr. Farah Karim Cooper. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe and what's on, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.